You know, leftist teachers and administrators are indoctrinating the next generation. That's why the conservative student in your life needs Young America's Foundation. Students ages 13 and older can apply for YAF's individual membership program and connect with like-minded students, learn from leaders of the conservative movement, gain skills and materials to advance their ideas, and much, much more. Apply today at www.yaf.org and receive a free membership pack. Again, that's www.yaf.org. Please check it out.
Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Jewish War by Josephus. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. This episode is sponsored by the podcast Subtext, and I'll tell you more about that in just a moment. Our guest is Barry Strauss, a professor of history and classics at Cornell University. His books include The Death of Caesar and 10 Caesars, as well as a forthcoming book in 2022 called The War That Made the Roman Empire, Antony, Cleopatra, and Octavian at Actium. He also has his own podcast. You can learn more about him at his website, barrystrauss.com. He podcasted with us a few years ago on The Gallic War by Julius Caesar, which is show number 32 in the Great Books podcast series. He joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Barry, welcome to the Great Books podcast.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why is The Jewish War by Josephus a great book?
Well, it's a great book because it covers an immensely important and fascinating subject. And that is the war between the Jews and Rome in the first century of our era that led to the destruction of the temple and the devastation of Jerusalem. This is one of the events that resonates most in the history of the Western world because as a result of it, it led to the creation of two religions, Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity. They both were shocked to the core by the events of this war. And Josephus is an eyewitness, so tremendously important and valuable.
We're going to talk about all that, the war, its legacy, the author and the controversies that surround him, his entire body of work beyond this early and important text, what he says about early Christianity, Judaism, and more. Let's start, Barry, with the title, The Jewish War, and also some context. Who were these Jews? Whom were they fighting and why?
The Jewish War, that, of course, is looking at things from the Roman point of view. From the Roman point of view, it was a Jewish war. More accurately, I think it would be a Judean war. It was a war of Rome against a rebel province, the province of Judea. There were Jews elsewhere in the Roman Empire and outside the Roman Empire as well. But this was specifically a war about a provincial rebellion. That province, of course, was not just any old place, but it was the Jewish homeland and the center of the Jewish identity, Jewish religion, and Jerusalem and the temple. From the Jewish point of view, it could just as well be called the Roman War, because it was the war it was a war against the Romans.
Josephus was born in 37 AD. He lived to about the year 100 AD. This book, The Jewish War, that's what we'll call it for this show, The Jewish War, written and released in roughly the year 75 AD. What period exactly does it cover, though? Because he's an eyewitness to many events, but it also goes deeper into history.
Yeah, it goes all the way back into the Maccabean period, if not before, so the second century BCE. There's a long wind-up before he gets to the actual Jewish War, and he sees the war as part of a longer relationship between Rome and the Jews and between Judea and the wider world, both the Hellenistic kingdoms of the East, the Greek-speaking kingdoms of the East, and the Roman Empire. So all of that is in the background. The focus is on the period of the war in the 60s of the Common Era.
And these are some of the most important parts, really the most important parts of the book. So what is happening in the initial phases of this war? What is he seeing and doing?
Josephus comes from a priestly family of Jerusalem, that is to say an aristocratic family. He is part of the elite. the cultural and religious and political elite of Judea. The war had been a long time coming. There'd been a lot of opposition within Judea, first of all, to the monarchy that collaborated with the Romans. And this is the monarchy most famously or infamously of King Herod, who had been dead for 75 years when the war began, or 70 years when the war began, and his successors. But also against the Romans, Judea had become a Roman province that had lost its independence. The Roman government had mistreated the Jews in one way in terms of public relations, and also in terms of interfering with the temple.
So Josephus is a participant in this fighting, isn't he?
Yes. So Josephus is chosen as one of the generals. He is the commander of Galilee, of the northern district. And so he is really on the front lines and about the first to face the Roman legions that are sent by the Emperor Nero to put down the revolt. And these are legions under the command of a veteran, prominent Roman general named Vespasian. And Vespasian defeats Josephus at the siege of a place called Yotapata, a small city in the Galilee. And Josephus is part of a group that have decided on a suicide pact, to commit suicide rather than to surrender to the Romans. But lots are drawn, and when there are only two men left, Josephus and a fellow commander, he says, look, there's no point in committing suicide. Let's agree to surrender to the Romans instead. And so they do. As Josephus tells the story, he predicts to the Roman commander Vespasian that he, Vespasian, will become emperor. It's not a wild prediction, but it's certainly not something that could be guaranteed. And in fact, it takes place. Nero is assassinated, and Vespasian vies for the throne, ultimately successfully. So he releases Josephus from captivity and treats Josephus as an honored guest because he has predicted Vespasian's success.
So this all works out pretty well for Josephus. But Yotapata is really controversial, right? I mean, there's a suicide pact, and when it gets to be his turn, he's like, oh, wait a second.
Yeah.
And it raises the question about whose side is he really on? Is this guy a Jewish patriot, or is he like the Hebrew Benedict Arnold?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't think it's fair to say that he's the Hebrew Benedict Arnold. He's with Vespasian, and when Vespasian leaves and turns things over to his son Titus, he's with Titus. And what Josephus tries to do when he's with the Roman army is he goes into Jerusalem and he tries to convince people in Jerusalem to surrender, to give up to the Romans before it's too late. And Josephus's line surely is that it's hopeless. Resistance is hopeless, and it will the end will be terrible. Because if Jerusalem doesn't surrender, then the Romans, by the laws of war, have the right to destroy Jerusalem and to kill or enslave anyone who lives there. So for heaven's sake, please give up now while you possibly can. We could call that treason, but we could also say that Josephus realized that the revolt had no chance of succeeding, and he was doing everything he could to try to convince his countrymen to change course before it was too late.
So this might, in fact, be really good advice, but what happens?
Well, it was excellent advice, but it's not taken. And the siege goes on to the bitter end. The Romans, not surprisingly, take Jerusalem, and they destroy the temple. Now, as Josephus tells the story, that was an accident. Titus didn't want to destroy the temple, but some of his soldiers took matters into their own hands and did so. And historians today are really divided as to whether they believe Josephus or not. Some very good scholars argue that actually this is credible. It was really not in Titus's interest to destroy the temple, and it probably was an accident. Others say, well, you know, the Romans, when they put down revolts, really do like to destroy capital cities root and branch. So it's not particularly surprising that Titus would have done this. And then that Josephus, who that by that point is living in Rome, and he basically is living on the goodwill of the Flavian dynasty, the dynasty of Vespasian and his sons, it wouldn't be surprising that Josephus would put a good spin on this, regardless of what really happened.
Tell us about the destruction of the temple. How destructive was that for the Jewish people? Why is that such a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal because for the Jews, as for all ancient peoples, the temple or temples and the holy point of their city was really the center of their life as a nation. Just as in Athens, people sacrificed to Athena, so in Jerusalem, people sacrificed to the God of Israel. And this was considered to be the centerpiece of what it meant to be a Jew. In fact, Jews from around the Roman Empire would contribute, they'd pay an annual tax to the temple to support the upkeep of the temple. So it was one of the greatest, and some would say the greatest and most spectacular temple of the ancient world at this period. Its destruction was devastating. Of course, it had happened before. The Babylonians had destroyed the first temple. So the Jews had coped with this before. And there are other nodes, there are other loci and focuses of the Jewish religion, but the temple is the big one. So it is tremendously important. It's also tremendously important for those Jews who consider themselves followers of Christ, of Jesus, who had been crucified 30-some odd years before, and who had predicted that one day the temple would be destroyed. So for followers of Jesus, for followers of Christ, this was a sign that his prophecy had come true. So it meant a lot to them as well. It meant a lot to all Jews.
I want to ask about early Christianity and Jesus and what Josephus has to say about all that in just a moment. There's one more story, though, from the Jewish War that we should discuss, because with the sack and the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, that's not the end of the war, actually. They keep fighting on, and we find ourselves in a place called Masada. And Josephus describes what happens there. What is Masada? What is that story?
So Masada is a fortress on the west shore of the Dead Sea, or it's not quite on the shore. It's near the west of the Dead Sea. It's a natural fortress. It's very dramatic rock. And Josephus tells the story of how 900-some-odd rebels, a group called the Sicarii, which is not a really nice name. It kind of means I mean, something like hitmen or the people who carry knives that are used by hitmen and highwaymen. These are a sect, not the leading group of the rebellion in Jerusalem, but yet a splinter group who saw themselves as purer than pure. They had actually not gone to the aid of Jerusalem, and they had massacred some Jewish civilians in order to supply themselves. They were holed up in this fortress at Masada, and the Romans were determined to bring them down. And as Josephus tells us, it's this very dramatic story in which the rebels on Masada decide to commit mass suicide, over 900 people, rather than surrender to the Romans. It's a very dramatic ending for Josephus's book. And also has had huge symbolism in Jewish history, particularly in the Zionist movement and in the creation of the state of Israel. Masada was seen as a symbol of the Jewish spirit of resistance. A slogan of modern Zionism is "Masada shall not fall again." It was excavated in the 1960s and afterwards by Yigal Yadin, who was both an Israeli general and a archaeologist, and he excavated both the Roman camps, the remains of the Roman camps at the foot of Masada, and the Roman ramp that allowed the legions to go up to Masada, as well as the top of Masada itself. Masada had a palace by King Herod. He put a palace there, but it was also meant to be a refuge in case he needed to flee in a hurry. So it was well fortified.
It's an amazing site. I've been there, and if you ever go to Israel, this is a must see site if you can fit it on your itinerary, and it's a popular tourist attraction. It means so much to the state of Israel, as you say. We know it actually happened. This is real history. There was a siege. The Romans and the Jews fought at Masada. The suicide story is moving. It's emotional. Is it true? Our only source is Josephus, and there is a question about how accurate it was. He wasn't there for this.
No, he wasn't there for it. And it's the sort of story that ancient historians, I love them dearly, but ancient historians are capable of exaggerating for rhetorical impact. There are some things about the story that are inherently implausible. It's implausible the way Josephus tells it. The Romans break through, and then they give the Jews on the top of Masada a night to surrender, instead of immediately going and once they break through, immediately going in and taking them down. That gives the rebel leader the time to make speeches, very powerful speeches, urging the people to commit suicide. Speeches in ancient historians are not really very trustworthy, with some exceptions. But on the whole, they're not terribly trustworthy. And it seems as if Josephus has, if not made them up out of whole cloth, then certainly exaggerated them considerably. Yadin suggested that the archaeology supports Josephus' story, but I think in the cold light of day, it does not. It does not really give any support to Josephus' story. If 900 some odd people, men, women, and children, committed suicide, there's certainly not archaeological evidence of it. It is not implausible that some of them committed suicide, and not implausible that the Roman legions killed or enslaved the rest. That seems to be a more likely explanation of what happened at Masada than a mass suicide of everyone there. But it must be admitted that at the end of the day, we don't know.
You're listening to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review, and I want to tell you about our sponsor, Subtext. Love the humanities, but not so much a fan of listening to lectures? Then try Subtext Literature and Film Podcast at subtextpodcast.com. In each episode, Wes Allwun and the poet Aaron Olonek explore life's big questions by way of an in-depth discussion of a great work of fiction, film, drama, or poetry. In the tradition of a liberal arts seminar, Subtext focuses on the insights into the human condition that make these texts timeless, insights that can change the way we view ourselves and our lives. Recent episodes include conversations about the relationship between imagination and ambition in Shakespeare's Macbeth, how to square honor and justice in the film The Godfather, the connection between the political and the spiritual in the short stories of Anton Chekhov, the power of art to persevere in Percy Shelley's poem Ozymandias, and the developmental psychology of magic in The Wizard of Oz. So if you love close readings of great books and film, go to subtextpodcast.com or search Subtext on the podcast app of your choice. That's subtextpodcast.com, S-U-B-T-E-X-T podcast.com, or search for Subtext on the podcast app of your choice. So, Barry, how great of an historian was this guy? Is he one of the great historians of the ancient world? Is he on par with Herodotus and Thucydides, or is he in another kind of category?
From my point of view, from the point of view of great literature and the pleasure that the reader takes in reading the text, no, Josephus is not on a par with Herodotus or Thucydides or Livy. He's not as great a storyteller. For one thing, and the book is in Greek, which is not even his native language, and that he doesn't speak all that well. He suggests that there was an earlier version in his native language, which was surely Aramaic, though he doesn't say so, but it's written in a foreign language. And I think most people would agree that it doesn't read as well as Thucydides or especially Herodotus. It's important more for the information it imparts. And there are some very dramatic scenes in Josephus. In addition to Masada, there is the destruction of the temple. There is the siege of Jotapata and Josephus's unintentionally comic decision to surrender to Vespasian rather than commit suicide. There's also a wonderful description of the Roman army on the march. It's quite dramatic and vivid, and maybe the best that we have in ancient literature. But the book as a whole, I wouldn't put it in the league with Herodotus or Livy, which are two of the more enjoyable books to read.
And yet we need it, don't we? This is our only source for a lot of events from that period, and our best source for many of them.
Yes. I mean, in terms of being a historian with a capital H, There are many texts from the ancient Jewish world that are useful for historians and contain historical data, but Josephus is the only one to survive that is really writing in the formal literary style of a historian as you would find in Greek or in Latin.
You mentioned that his native language probably would have been Aramaic, and there may be a text written in that language. It does not survive. We do have a Greek version, which he possibly translated himself into Greek. But is there an English version we should read? If our listeners want to try Josephus, is there a particular translation or edition or book about him that you would recommend?
Well, there are two good translations, one in the Penguin Library, which is quite good, and the other in Oxford World's Classics, which is very good as well. They're both excellent choices in order to approach Josephus.
One of the reasons we're so interested in this book is because it's a non-biblical source of information on biblical times, and that matters, of course, to Jewish people today, to Christians, and so forth. What do we learn about that period and these faiths from Josephus we might not know without his having written these works?
Well, Josephus provides a lot of information about different groups within first century Judaism. In addition to the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Essenes, who many people would think are the people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, the texts of what we know as the Dead Sea Scrolls. Josephus gives us real insight into the variety of Judaism in the period. Also tells us a lot about King Herod, and tells us a lot about the Temple and how it worked in Jerusalem in that era. And of course, he is full of information and insights about the Jewish war and the different factions and different groups within Jewish society in that period.
The Jewish War was not his only text. There are others. There's another one called Antiquities of the Jews, and there are more. But when we look at his entire body of work, what does it tell us about early Christianity? What does it say about Jesus, if anything?
Josephus is a tremendously important text for telling us about the background of life in Judea, in the land of Israel or Palestine, in that period more generally. And there are three passages in the Antiquities of the Jews that are of great importance for early Christians. One is a reference to John the Baptist. Another is a reference to James, the brother of Jesus, and the third one is a reference to Jesus himself. The one about John the Baptist, relatively uncontroversial. I don't think anyone doubts its authenticity. The one about James, the brother of Jesus, whom some called the Christ, I think most scholars recognize that as well. The one that's controversial is the so-called Testimonium Flavianum, the testimony about Jesus. And in this one, Josephus talks more at length about Jesus. He talks about Jesus, who he calls a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. He praises Jesus for being a teacher of people who accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and Greeks. He was the Christ. And when upon the accusation of the principal men among us, Pilate condemned him to a cross. Those who first came to love him did not cease. He appeared to them on the third day restored to life, and the tribe of the Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. And I would say there are three schools of thought about this text among scholars. One is, yep, this is exactly what Josephus wrote. The second one is, nonsense, this is entirely a Christian interpolation in Josephus's text. And then the third one, which I personally find persuasive, is that Josephus really did write something like this, but it was tinkered with by later Christian sources to have Josephus say that perhaps Jesus should not be called a man, that he was teaching the truth, he was condemned upon the accusation of the principal men among us, and that he was restored to life on the third day. Some or all of these might be later interpolations. But personally, I see no reason to doubt that Josephus would have written about Jesus and said that he's called the Christ by some and that he has many followers. Josephus is writing about the Jewish world. And are early Christians, early Christianity was a Jewish sect. And the early Christians, the first Christians, saw themselves as Jews like other Jews. So I don't see why Josephus wouldn't include that.
Finish out the biographical story of Josephus for us. He went to Rome. Did he fully assimilate into the Roman world, Roman life? Did he remain Jewish? What do we know about the end for this guy?
So Josephus goes to Rome, and he's actually living in the house of Vespasian, the place where Vespasian lived before he moves onto the Palatine Hill as the emperor. So he's living in luxury as a result of his good relations with Vespasian and his family. But Josephus never ceases to be a Jew, and one of his points is to show that the Jews are a high-spirited and noble people who did not revolt against the Romans for frivolous reasons, but for important ones and valid ones, and who continue to believe in their God and their religion even without the temple, who should be allowed indeed to rebuild the temple, which Josephus very much wanted to see happen, as did most Jews. One of the purposes of the Masada story is to imbue the Jews with dignity and nobility in the minds of Roman readers. So there's certainly a debate among scholars and non-scholars as to whether Josephus was a traitor or not. And I think the defense of Josephus is that while some of the things he did are questionable, he never stopped feeling that he was loyal to the Jews and loyal to Judea. And although he lived in Rome, in some sense, he saw himself as the Jews' man in Rome, and who is there to represent Jewish interests and to remind the Romans not to mistreat the Jews. I mean, so much of the Flavian dynasty and Vespasian and his sons, so much of their legitimacy came from them exaggerating the significance of their victory against this rebellious province. Much of Rome was rebuilt under the Flavians to commemorate their victory in the Jewish War. The most famous example of that is the Colosseum, which was built in whole or in part, more likely in part than in whole, from booty that had been won in the Jewish War. And of course, the Arch of Titus, which you can see today in Rome, specifically advertises the Flavian victory. But there are other monuments in Rome as well that are not so visible, not so easily seen, but you can see them. So Josephus is there to say, not so fast, you know, let's not put the Jews into the dustbin of history. Let's remember who they are. And so I think he would see himself as serving a really important purpose among the Romans. His last book is a book called Against Appian, and it's written against a Greek from Alexandria who serves up the by now familiar charges against the Jews as disloyal and enemies of humanity because they won't eat with other people, because they keep to their own ways. And Josephus tries to defend the Jews against this charge, and he's writing to a wider audience in the Roman and the Greco-Roman world.
Barry, one more question. We're just about out of time. You are a professor of history and classics. You're an expert on the ancient world, the classical world, particularly the Roman world. How did you discover Josephus as a reader? Was it an assignment in graduate school? Did you pick it up on your own? What's your story of encountering Josephus?
I think I encountered Josephus probably picking it up on my own, and I did so for two reasons. One is it's a remarkably important text about the Roman Empire and the point of view of the Roman Empire by a provincial. And the other, quite frankly, is I'm a Jew, so naturally I'm interested in Jewish history and the relation of the history of the Jews in the Roman period, which is one that I studied very well. So it interested me from both of those point of views.
Barry Strauss, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Jewish War by Josephus.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.